This episode is brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. Collecting watches is fun. Insuring watches is not. But with Hodinkee Insurance, we've teamed up with Chubb, the premier insurer of valuable collections, to offer a better and more seamless experience to insure your watches and even jewelry. Minimizing the paperwork and maximizing the protection so you can stop worrying about your watches and focus on enjoying them. Hodinkee Insurance, protect what you love. Visit insurance.hodinkee.com for more details. There's no one quite like Max Bucer in the watch world. Each of his creations is so innovative, unique, and cutting edge, but also all clearly from the same mind, challenging the conventions of watchmaking. He got his start in watches working with Jaeger LeCoultre during the rebirth of traditional watchmaking in the 1990s. From there, he joined Harry Winston and launched its Opus series, collaborating with independent watchmakers like F.P. Jorn. Then, in 2005, he started his own brand, Max Bucer & Friends. His horological and legacy machines are like no other watches, pieces of kinetic art. On today's episode, Max joins Ben and me to talk about his entire career, including his nearly 20 years at MB&F. We also talk about the current state of innovation and creativity in the watch industry. We also discuss the recent investment in MB&F by Chanel and what's next for MB&F. Without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Max and Ben. Max Bucer, thank you so much for joining Hodinkee Radio. It's been a while since we had you on the show or on the website, so welcome back.
Thank you, Tony. It's a great pleasure being here.
And of course, we've got the founder, Ben Clymer, here as well. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Tony. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining the show. Guys, before we get into anything that's going on with MB&F and you, Max, you guys go way back, obviously. Do you remember, Max, I guess I'll direct it to you first, when you first became aware of Hodinkee, and then after that, when you first may have met our own Mr. Clymer?
I don't remember exactly. That's what getting old gets you to. I remember being one of the first fans, because let's not forget that in those days, anybody would speak about us, we would love. And so Hodinkee, so Ben started covering what we were doing. And I have this memory of one time I visited New York, and we met up and we went into my hotel room, and Ben had his iPhone, so it couldn't be like 14, 15 years ago. I don't know, and he put it on an easel, and he interviewed me. It was the first time ever somebody filmed me during an interview, and it was in my hotel room. And it was, for me, incredible. It was the first, and you always remember the first.
Ben, from there it obviously grew, and then the first limited edition that Hodinkee ever did was just a few years after that fateful hotel interview. What do you remember about that and the stainless steel LM101?
Look, but before the LM101, there was something called the Music Machine, which, this is not a plant, sits in my office right there. There it is right there. We kept one, and that's, I think that's number 5 of 5. So before the watch was the Music Machine. But before that, and I don't think anybody knows this, and I don't even know if Max will remember this, there was, you know, as many of you do know, I come from, you know, I would say very middle class upbringing. Both my parents were basically public school teachers. It was like, I didn't come into this with the ability to purchase watches at all. The very first nice watch I bought myself was a Rolex Explorer, then a Rolex Mariner. Then I saved up, and on a payment plan, I bought a Royal Oak, an A series Royal Oak. The watch I bought after that was actually an HM2 that Max was great. I think the retail on that watch, I mean, you would know better than I, was like, what, 75, 80, something like
that? 68. Like that, yeah.
And I said, I really love this thing. And Max was like, hey, like, you know, we could probably figure something out here. So, you know, we did. And I bought an HM2 in white gold, which, for those who don't remember, is kind of like the cassette looking watch, you know, kind of rectangular watch. And if you look back at some of the early features on Hodinkee, including in the New York Times, I'm wearing an HM2 in white gold, which, you know, was just like such a revelation in terms of what watchmaking could be. I mean, a Submariner to me was crazy. A Royal Oak was beyond crazy. An HM2 in 2000, and I'm going to say 10 or 11. I mean, this was wild to me. This was fantasy.
It was a pretty wild watch. I mean, it was also a wild era. That all sort of stopped the wild world after 2009. But if I look back today, it's a 58 millimeter white watch. And I look at it today, I'm like, wow. And especially in an era of vintage looking watches, you look at an HM2, it seems like something completely alien.
It does. It really does. But that watch had really opened my eyes up to what the real Swiss watchmaking industry was, because it introduced me to Jean-Marc Wiederecht, who did the retrograde on that, obviously, and several other of your suppliers. And I think that was really eye-opening to me and really changed my perspective, because I believed at the time that, you know, it was Max Bucer himself sitting in a workshop creating these watches all by himself, you know? And even when I first visited AP, I had no understanding of how the supply network worked at AP and, of course, Rolex. But that watch really changed my perception of things just from a quality perspective, because my Royal Oak at the time was 40 years old. It was a 1972 watch. And then this was a modern contemporary high-end watch, and it really just changed things for me. So that was a totally game-changing ownership perspective for me. And that, of course, I've since gone on to buy other MB&S and other high-end watches, but that was a big moment for me to get that thing.
Max, what Ben says obviously gets to the very foundation of your company. It's obviously in the name there. Do you think the philosophy in which you kind of lay out your suppliers and your friends that are involved in every single project, from the PR down to every single component of the movement, do you think that's had an impact? Ben mentioned how it's had an impact on him. Do you think it's had a larger impact on the watch world in general, in terms of transparency and talking about your suppliers and just changing the way in which people understand these things?
I'm not sure. I would like to think that we've had an impact, but I'm actually not sure. It's still absolutely amazing to me the amount of people who even purchase one of our watches are not aware that we actually credit everybody who works on them. I still have colleagues in the industry calling me up saying, "Oh, who does this for you?" I'm like, "Well, it's on our website." "Oh, really?" For us, it was very important because it's part of the fundamental definition of what MB&F stands for: people the way you want to be treated. But I'm not exactly sure we helped. I hope we did. And if we did, all the better.
The big theme, I think, that is overarching in everything you talk about with MB&F, interviews you've done, the way in which you present the company, is kind of rediscovering childhood through creativity. One of your unofficial mottos, maybe even it's official, I think, is "a creative adult is a child who survived," something you've said over and over again that I think it resonates with a lot of people. So maybe we'll start here. What do you think a kid or a child Max Bucer would think of MB&F and what you've built with the company?
If it's the 13-year-old me, would probably say, "What the hell? You were supposed to be creating cars. Why are you doing watches?" But if I look a little bit further, wow, I think I never, ever, ever imagined as a kid that I would be able to create everything I've created and bring together the people. And it was interesting because at the end of last year, I was doing the performance reviews of my team, and Harris, who you probably know, our communication director, has been with me for 13 years, and I asked him how I could improve. And he looked at me and he said, "We would like you to be happier." I was like, "What? What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, you're always on the edge. You're always thinking 2 years ahead, 5 years ahead, what could go wrong, etc. Look at what we've managed in 19 years to do. It's pretty insane." And yes, I am. I'm incredibly grateful. I'm incredibly happy. But at the same time, my software has been programmed after 20 years of being a gazelle in the savannah and waiting for the leopard, the lion, the hyena. It was not about if, it was about when they would turn up. And you realize that I've been way too much thinking always of what could go wrong. But at the end of the day, if I take a step back, wow. Wow, what a story, what a journey.
You know, what you mentioned there, Stephen McDonnell, your frequent collaborator, gave a great talk at Dubai Watch Week last year, obviously talking about the sequential and the development of the sequential and collaborating with you on it. One of the things he mentions that he was talking about with you at the time was the way in which it drives him almost insane, what you're talking about right now, thinking about what might go wrong, what you hadn't thought of in the movement or the caliber that could go wrong, sort of what's lying in wait for you. How do you, have you gotten better at dealing with that over your sort of 19 years and the however many calibers you've developed over your time, almost 20 years at MB&F?
I have to learn to be in the moment. I never look back. Well, now I'm a little bit forced because there was the Catalogue Raisonné, and then now we're coming up to the 20th anniversary. So we have to go and revisit the past. And I rarely do that, but that's not an issue. The issue is that I'm not in the moment. And I'm not in the moment enough with my family. I'm not in the moment with my team. I don't celebrate enough. I'm always thinking of the next. And that's something I have to work on. Steeman is somebody who is extraordinary in every way. Extraordinary meaning he's the only genius I've met. Extraordinary, he's out of the ordinary. And his insane talent comes with a curse. And his curse is that everything has to be perfect. And if it's not perfect, he's in suffering, but it's serious suffering. I'm a perfectionist, but I've learned over the years that those taking it from 90% to 100%, those 10 extra percent are such a source of distress that sometimes it's better if you just stay at 90, 95% and you can let it go. So in that way, I've improved.
So you would say great is the enemy of good?
Well, it's yes. It depends where you put the cursor. I think we're in an industry which too often has put the cursor down. And I think it's very important that we keep that level of excellence and extraordinary and artisanship and hand finishing, etc. It's not only about the branding and the look of the product. But I've realized over the years that some tools you have to let go. It's just pointless, and you're just going to stop the whole machine if you're just getting intent on that specific battle.
I've heard you tell the story before of how you kind of, your baptism into the watch industry, if you will, was a university project, and it was in the early 90s, I guess it would have been. And the watch industry was quite small at the time, and you would send letters out to brands. And because it was quite small, you'd get CEOs or very high up people in the brand to respond. You mentioned you talked with a lot of the higher up folks at the time, one of whom was Gerald Genta, the, of course, famous designer, Royal Oak, and all these other things. I'm curious what you remember, if anything, about this encounter during your university years with Gerald Genta, anything he may have said to you at the time that stuck with you.
That was 35 years ago. But, you know, it's a good question that. The issue is that when I sent those letters out, I was actually not interested in the watch world. It was just a project as a student. And I didn't realize how extraordinary it was to meet Mr. Pollux, Mr. Urquhart, Mr. Belmore, and of course, Gerald Genta himself. I think the only thing I honestly remember of the meeting with Gerald Genta is that, I don't know if I'm going to dare say that, he was very, very, very proud of himself. And I remember that's the feeling I remember still today, leaving the place going, God, this guy's got a pretty high opinion of himself.
That's right. So after school, you've told the story before of how you ended up at Jaeger-LeCoultre, kind of a chance encounter, having coffee at the top of a mountain skiing in Switzerland, as one does. You spent 7 years at Jaeger-LeCoultre. I'm wondering if you can, this era of Jaeger-LeCoultre, might I add, is kind of utter fascination to me. And I could spend an entire episode just asking you about this time, but I'll spare the listeners this time around at least. And I'm wondering if you could summarize sort of, things you learned there, both in terms of how to do things and then perhaps how not to do them going forward in your career.
It was an extraordinary school. I mean, it was, I often say that I was blessed to enter Jaeger when it was more or less just coming out of bankruptcy and enter Harry Winston when it was going into bankruptcy, because you realize that you learn so much as a youngster coming out of college where you don't know anything, or you think you know but you don't know anything. And we were part of a very small team it was already a company with about 200, 220 employees, but it was making $17 million at 220 employees. I can tell you that's not a great business. And so what I learned was I learned how to work. I learned the power of giving a purpose to a team. And our purpose was trying to save that company. and it actually was trying to save the industry. We're all in it at rock bottom. And we're all friends. It's interesting. In those days, we were all friends. AP and Blancpain and Borguet, and we'd catch up for lunches and dinners. We were friends because we're all in it together. And I learned that what Henri-John Belmont taught us is that just bringing really nice people with a purpose together. There were no superstars. There were no Michael Jordans in that team. We moved mountains, and it was seven extraordinary years of, we made a lot of errors. We were all engineers and all product creators, and we're completely useless at getting the message out. So the only way we could actually try to make this business survive was to create new products. So that was fine with me, of course, but I was the product manager, but we get on churning out tens and dozens and hundreds of new references every year and try to sell them to retailers. Of course, in those days, no brand would sell directly to a client. You had to go through a retailer or distributor even before. And we were just like, we had this machine of coming out with new products all the time. And then we would see, oh, that failed, that failed, that failed. Oh, that actually worked. Oh, let's try and do more of that. So it was really a trial and error. But it just fit me very well, the fact of we're all engineers, all product creators, and we had a ball. It was quite a run.
Can we get specific? Like, what are some of the products that you're most proud of or most embarrassed by? And who else was with you? Any other names that we would remember?
Well, in those days, our little team was, of course, I mean, right on top, the legend, Günter Blümlein. And that was an incredible experience for me to be around him for 7 years. Henri-John Belmont was the boss. Jean-Pierre Sassard, he's passed away. He was the head of production. He was incredible. He was a machine. He brought that company while I was there from 200 to 800 people and everything. Remember, we were the manufacturer when nobody was a manufacturer in those days. So we were doing our own cases. We're doing our own movements. All our movements were made internally. That was unheard of 30 years ago. And so there was Yasmina Steele, who's been at Patek now for 25 years. There is Janek Deleskiewicz, of course, the designer who just retired a few years ago and accompanied Jaeger for better part, I think, of 30 years. We shared the same office together, and that was great. He would take out his saxophone in the end of the day and start playing in the office.
Tony does that for us sometimes.
That's right.
It was family, and it was fun, and I also have to thank Henri-John Belmont because he shielded us from the stress. I cannot even imagine, because afterwards in my life I had his job, and I realized what stress you have, and he completely shielded us and just let us do our job and enjoy it, and it was, I owe so much to Henri-John Belmont. I mean, without him, I don't know where I would be today.
Are there products that you? Still, Ben kind of asked it, products that you're most proud of. I mean, I associate the 90s very much from Jaeger nowadays with the, you know, it kind of started with the 60th anniversary of Reverso and then the complicated ones coming after that. But from your perspective inside of it, are there some that you're most proud of now?
Clearly, I mean, that series, which started in 91, the year I arrived, the 60th anniversary, which then was the Tourbillon, the Minute Repeater, the Chronograph, the Geographic. They just relaunched the Chronograph, of course, a whole new version of it. But that original 1996, I'm going to say, Chronograph, it was, those movements were so small, so beautiful, incredible value for money. And it tells you that branding, unfortunately, is very important in our industry because Jaeger didn't have the brand, power that other great brands like Audemars and Patek and Vacheron had. And just because of that, I don't think it was recognized to the level it should have. There was also, of course, the launch of the Master Control. So I arrive in 91 and we're coming out with all these different lines. I remember just when I arrived, we launched a line called the Gentilhomme. And the Gentilhomme was a complete ripoff of the Calatrava. But it was a copy of the Calatrava, but ours was automatic, while the Calatrava was hand winding. And the Calatrava was 9,500 francs, and the Gentilhomme automatic was 7,500 francs. So we thought, we're going to do a killing here. And our retailers thought also, and they all bought it. And they all stayed on the shelves for a good part of two decades, I think, because between 7,500 a Jaeger and 9,500 a Patek, it's a no-brainer. You go for the Patek. Automatic or not automatic, we learned the hard way. But then at some point, so we had the Seductrice, the Rendezvous, the original Rendezvous, which is a really cool watch. Unfortunately, it was quartz with a bezel which turns with a diamond on it, and you would actually place it in front of the time of your Rendezvous. It was like sort of a time counter. That was a beautiful watch, complete, but it was quartz and it just didn't work. There was the Krios, there was the Herion, there was the Odysseus, all things we have all forgotten, and probably for a good reason. And then came the Master. So in 92, we decide let's try and do a watch which is a little bit retro. There was no retro watches in the 90s. We were recreating a new industry. So it was, let's do something which looked a bit like the 50s, and which had this Master Control 1000 hours test on it. And oh gosh, did we learn. First of all, we learned, and I think enough years have gone by so I can say this, that I think that 40% of all the watches didn't pass the test, which was a big surprise for us, because watches in those days, and maybe still in many brands now, are tested for like 2 days, and that's it. And here, 1,000 hours is 6 weeks. And it was tested in all sorts of shocks, matic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we discovered that after a couple of weeks, things started going wrong. So that was a great learning curve. And I think Jaeger insanely improved the quality of their products thanks to that test. But what also hit us is that the amount of letters, in those days we got letters, there were no emails, we got letters of people writing to us and saying, I've got my Junghans Mega, which is linked to satellite, which that actually existed, and I've been counting the timing, and your watch is off 4 seconds a day. And we're like, well, that's great. And it's like, no, it's 1,000 hours control. It must not lose 4 seconds. I'm like, no, that's really cool. And so we realized that saying 1,000 hours control, people thought it was like a quartz watch. And we had to then change the perception and all that. So again, insane learning curves and trial and error. And I'm a little bit nostalgic of that era.
So can I ask something of an aside? Because, and it only was triggered because you mentioned the name Odysseus, which is now obviously used by Lange. And I would imagine that you are as well, but there's a few Lange fans on this podcast here. What was the perception of Lange working at JLD in the early 90s? Did you guys have visibility into what they were doing? Did it feel special back then? Or was it like these guys in Dresden, like what's going on over there?
So I was incredibly lucky to be in the inner sanctum. And so Günther Blümlein would come over every 2 to 3 months and to supervise, because he was the head of the three brands. And and he would show us the drawings, what he'd done with Mr. Mice. And I don't know if Kurt Klaus was it, but I think it was Mice mostly who did it. And I saw the Lange one. I was like, wow. And then, of course, there was the Pour le Mérite Tourbillon, the Cabaret, the Lange Matic. And I saw all those products, and he would show us, and he was very proud. And what's incredible is that, honestly, he virtually single-handedly built that company from scratch. And what's incredible is also that the Lange pocket watches didn't have, except for the design of the bridges, they didn't have really an aesthetic which you could recognize. And he basically created the aesthetic of what a Lange is today from scratch, more or less by his own. Günther was one of the greatest product creators I've ever met. And so it's interesting you mentioned that, because the one brand which was missing in my collection has been Lange. I've been procrastinating for years and years and years. And I actually just ordered one 10 days ago, and I got myself, it had to be a Lange one, because it's the Lange which I saw Günther create the brand. It's pretty extraordinary what he managed. Absolutely.
I have one right here. I'm a fan as well. Which one did you order, just out of curiosity?
I managed to get a Grand Lange one Lumen.
Nice.
Of course, that's after Günther Blümlein's era. I've been procrastinating just too long, and suddenly one popped up on my screen. I was like, you know what? if I'm going to do it, it's now.
But I'm just curious, like the perception of Germans making watches. How was that? You know, I've heard, and certainly not you, but others kind of say there was like a loose skepticism that they would be able to produce something that could compare to what the Swiss were able to do.
Well, look, I don't have to teach you that Swiss are like the biggest knobs in the universe. So
you said it, not me.
I mean, come on. And Swiss and watch industry. Oh my gosh. It was more just people very curious, but didn't expect it to work. And it also worked not only because the product was amazing in design, concept, and movement, but because he created a manufacturer from scratch in the middle of nowhere. You have to realize what era we were living in those days to realize how humongous an achievement that was. Today, it would be very complicated. Then, it was magic.
Can you talk a little bit more broadly about the energy in the Swiss watch industry at the time? You mentioned being friends, having lunch with Breguet, Blancpain, and people have rediscovered this era recently. Just this morning, we've been passing around the Philips catalog. There's a Philips catalog of 80s and 90s watches, from all of these brands, JLC and some of the other ones we've been talking about included. But can you talk more broadly about what the energy was like at the time? And did you guys know you were doing something that would be appreciated by a future generation? Or were you just doing whatever you could to stay alive?
The early 90s was very much staying alive, not the John Travolta way. It was very much just try to survive. And I think by 94, we started seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. But the whole industry was growing. Everything was growing. So everybody was doing better and better. And therefore, there was a camaraderie, which was pretty amazing. And so we were all rediscovering the archives. And what's interesting is if you look at the 90s watches, we didn't copy-paste. What we're doing today in 2024, which is copy-paste, we didn't do in those eras. We tried to create something which was contemporary with our vision of contemporary, of course, in those days. And so everyone had its own aesthetics, its own way of seeing the world, but they were not copy-paste of 50s and 60s watches. And then, of course, you arrive at the end of the 90s, and there's this beginning of this whole new other world, which is what we call it contemporary watchmaking. With, I'm going to say the missing link is a little bit for me is the Vianney Halter Antiqua. And then you have the Freak, of course, Oerwerk with the 103, Richard Mille. And you start having at the beginning of 2000s, a whole other story start. But the 90s was a really nice era. I remember every Basel World, it wasn't yet called Basel World, I think it was called the Basel Fair. We would all meet up, and it was a nice era.
The common perception nowadays is we have, on the one hand, a lot of creativity in small independent brands led, if I may say, by MB&F and perhaps a few others. And then on the other hand, oftentimes there's a perception at least that it's not the same at large brands. There's a lack of creativity, of innovation, whatever it is. I'm wondering if you perceive or feel the same dichotomy in your observations of where the Swiss watch industry is at right now.
It depends on the brand. Take a brand like Bulgari, which is arguably a big brand, and comes out with 2 to 4 calibers a year and some pretty cool and innovative products every year. And there are others which basically go back to their archives and reproduce the pieces, but with modern calibers. I think what didn't help is the last 10 years of going back to vintage. And when you have a heritage, it's a no-brainer. You go back to your archives and you relaunch. The independents don't have that luxury. It's not that I want it. I clearly don't want to come out with my HM1 again. But
Or HM2.
Yeah, or HM2, clearly. HM3 is cool. When you're a big brand which has a heritage and all it has to do is go back to its archives, you don't really have an incentive to innovate too much. So let's not be too tough on them. But there are some who are much more innovative than others. And look, face it, I feel like saying it depends on, I'm going to make a lot of friends again. It depends on how powerful your CFO is. What I mean is that if you're $1 billion a year company and you come out with one caliber every 2 years, you can't have that caliber sell only 100 pieces a year. You're going to have it make a sell at least 10,000, 15,000, whatever. I don't know how many you're going to make. And so your necessity to amortize and have big revenues based on whatever you come out with won't allow you to take too many risks. So if you can basically put your CFO in the cellar and close the door, you will have more creativity.
Ben, as someone who got started in the vintage world as much as any, but latched onto things like the HM2 pretty quickly, any additional perspective on the matter?
There's a lot of things that I think Max and I would probably like to say that we can. But, you know, I think there are people that are doing amazing things, obviously Max included, Recep. I mean, Recep worked at Patek, right? Like he came from one of the great brands and he's doing amazingly innovative things. I think there are brands that definitely rest on their laurels. And I think there are other brands that are doing really interesting things. And I think there's a few frustrations that I have as kind of like this, you know, liaison between the people like Max that are really creating and then the community at large. And I'll run down two of them. One of which is that money is bad in the watchmaking industry. And when you look at Günter Blümlein and you look at what eventually became Richemont, without people like that, Jaeger, Vacheron, IWC, Lange, et cetera, basically don't exist. And Max, feel free to disagree, obviously, if I'm saying anything out of line here. And then you have LVMH, of course, doing kind of similar kind of roll-ups. And again, you can criticize the idea of large conglomerates, et cetera. But I think that it's indisputable that without groups like that, luxury and the watchmaking that we know it today doesn't exist. Lange isn't able to make a Dave Graff caliber without the investment that comes with large kind of corporate entities behind it. Agreed that there needs to be controls, obviously, with CFOs, et cetera. And then the other thing is, like, I'm really thinking of Patek and AP in particular. You know, a common kind of statement that's said on Instagram and in our comment section is that, you know, AP is just resting on their laurels and making the Royal Oak over and over again. Okay, yes. From a case design perspective, there's a lot of Royal Oaks out there. But when you look at the calibers of like the RD2, RD3, all the RDs, basically, the concept stuff that they've been doing for 30 years now, you know, this is really innovative stuff. And I think it's frustrating from my vantage point, seeing a larger part of the industry that people don't recognize what it takes to develop a caliber, which is a non sequitur of some sort. But I would ask Max, who has developed calibers, like, what does it take to make a new caliber? And when AP says, hey, we're going to do, you know, the thinnest self-winding flying tourbillon with the RD3 or whatever, what type of... what type of investment is required? What is needed to make that happen? And then does a brand like AP, as an example, need to do that stuff? Clearly not, right? Like they could put a quartz, they have put a quartz movement in a Royal Oak and still sell them just as well. And so how do you view, as somebody who's making this stuff, the idea of like resting on laurels and then the idea of innovating with a caliber?
Well, first of all, I have to agree with you that AP has been an incredibly innovative company caliber-wise, for sure. And it's true, just because they often put them in Royal Oaks, we dismiss them too easily. Look, for us, creating a caliber is a 3 to 5 year process, and we come out with one every year. So you understand my life is a layer cake de facto. And it's millions and millions of dollars. Now, when you're a small company, I was ready to create a caliber and only craft 25 a year, you will do everything in CNC and you will adjust manually. And so your cost of your caliber is humongous, but you can go much faster than if you're a brand trying to make 10,000 of that same caliber a year, because there you're going to actually have tons of toolings made to stamp parts out, and just to do the toolings was cost you a couple of million, but it takes a lot of time. And basically to when you do 5,000, 10,000 of the same caliber every year, you industrialize it. And that takes way more time. Then of course, your cost of your caliber is much lower because it's been industrialized. So us small independents tend to be able to be more prolific because we can go faster, but our costs are exponential of manufacturing. And it's a trade-off I'm very, very happy to have. I've no problem with that.
Another sort of recurring theme I hear when you talk, Max, is the idea of risk-taking and challenging yourself. And if you start to feel comfortable, you feel bored. This is coming off of the question, or it's coming off of what you just mentioned there. 3 to 5 years in advance is how far out you have to think of calibers. But I'm curious what you're doing now in terms of risk-taking, challenging yourself or your company, MBNF, now to keep yourself sort of excited and engaged in even 20 years on.
I have to credit Michael Tay, the owner of the Hourglass, who in 2018, in a meeting in Singapore, looked at me and said, "You're becoming predictable." And that single phrase, which honestly I hated it on the moment, and I thought, "How dare you?" has saved me, because maybe I had gone into a cycle. I think all of us creators have a first 10 years of our brand where we churn out all these crazy ideas which have been pent up in us. And then there is the danger that you start evolving, copying yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't realize that. And I have to thank Mike for that, because he really gave me an electroshock. And from there, a lot of things came out. The HM11 Architect, which we released last year, that was really, okay, stop going back to your childhood sort of thing, grow up. The Mad One, of course, which I designed, and I had the courage in 2021 to come out with it, but also all sorts of new concepts you're going to see coming out from next year onwards. I had a basket of projects which just didn't fit. And I thought, my brand is already complicated enough. We've got horology machines, legacy machines. Now we've got mad editions. There are clocks, which are co-creations. There's performance art, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I can't do an elevator pitch on MBNF. It's impossible. And so I had all these projects which were none of all that. And the success we started having in the last 3 years, the demand being suddenly there when for 16 years we were running around the planet saying, please try and buy one of my watches. That gave us the courage now to come out with products which you really don't expect. And they're not HMs, they're not LMs. You don't even know what they are, but they're cool. And they're really things which we really in love with. So I feel like saying that I think success is very dangerous, and you may have already heard me say that. It leads usually to taking less risks, being less creative. And we have used this as a springboard the last 3 years to have the courage to come out with all sorts of new ideas that we didn't dare to do before. So I'll keep you posted.
Can I ask a question? Many years ago, I would say probably, I would guess 2016, 17, you and I had breakfast together in New York. Anyway, I think it was just after the launch of LM1 or one, it was probably 101. And
it was 2014.
LM101. And I said, man, like if I was going to buy a modern MBNF, it'd be the LM101 because like, you know me, like I'm wearing a cashmere cardigan right now. Like that's my aesthetic, you know? And you said, okay, I get that. You are one of the few. And in fact, I think at the time, the LMs, the ones and the 101s weren't selling that well. And your advice to me, or just a broader statement, was that the HM watches, I guess my assumption was that because I thought everyone was like me, which is clearly, thank God, not the case, that the LMs would be doing exceptionally well because they're round, they're more understated, they're the traditional watches, whereas the HMs are fucking crazy, right? Like these are nutty things. These are supercars. And you said, it's actually quite the opposite, at least back then. The HMs are so different than everything else. If you want one of these, there's nowhere else to go. Okay, Erwerk, maybe, you know, something like that. Grubel, maybe. But for an LM, okay, if you want a finely finished watch by Kari, you can go to Kari. You can go to Philippe Dufour. You can go to Patek. You can go to Lange. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like things changed and the LM started to kind of take, I wouldn't say take over, but really became very, very collectible. And demand went up and they started selling for above retail. What happened to you, or what happened in the market to make that shift from the crazy HMs being, you know, the hot MBNFs to the LMs being so special?
I actually don't know. I was a spectator looking at what was happening. And you're right. Our biggest historical flop, apart from HM5, was LM101, meaning it came out in 2014. And from 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, we couldn't give them away. I was very lucky.
Wait for the record answer.
Exactly.
That answers the question.
Why Max website. Yeah. There's a little website wanted to do 10 pieces. I was like, take them.
Yeah, take them, whatever.
And honestly, I'm not joking. We couldn't sell 20 or 25 a year. You can ask Laurent Pichotto, any of our historical retailers. Laurent had them in stock for like 5 years and he was telling me, can you buy them back? I just can't sell these damn things. And then 2020 arrived and suddenly everybody's like, how can I get an LM101? And we were looking at these people going, where were you guys over the last 6-7 years? And yes, then it became massive waiting lists and over with premiums, etc. Again, I think it's a good example that you should never create a product because you think it's going to work. You should create a product because you love it and don't care what the trends of the market are. And maybe with a bit of luck, it will sell. And maybe it will only sell in 6 years, like LM101, which took 6 years. That's a long time. And the only reason I kept producing it, is I just couldn't amortize the humongous R&D of that of that particular movement, all our movements. So it's true that up till 2020, I think at the best, legacy machines represented 30% of our revenue. And then there was sort of a shift. A tectonic shift where from 21 onwards, everybody wanted legacy machines. It also, we didn't come out with that many HMs anymore. There was not that much choice. So we also made it that at some point, if you wanted an MBNF, you were going to more or less going to have to buy an LM at some point. And now the shift is going back a little bit to HM.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you've managed growth at MBNF over the duration of its existence? You kind of very famously did not increase production for quite a while. And then, as you're kind of mentioning here, they reached an inflection point where you just couldn't hold back the demand anymore and changed your philosophy. And then now we're kind of back to where we were in 2013. Can you just kind of talk about that perspective?
So yeah, I had this, I didn't have a business plan when I launched the company. I just had an Excel spreadsheet, which told me that I didn't have enough money by far. And where my dream on that Excel spreadsheet was to at some point arrive at about 300 watches a year for about 15 million Swiss francs revenue. And we hit that in 2013, which was the same year my first daughter was born. The revenue stayed flat. Then 17th of March 2020, we send everybody back home in lockdown and we think it's the end of the world. And by June, we realize it's not the end of the world at all. On the contrary, suddenly everybody's asking to buy watches. I'm like, really? And the demand started becoming humongous. And there, I think the worst reason to grow a company is because you can. We didn't want to. We kept on saying no. And at the same time, started the whole project of what happens if something happens to me? How does this company survive if I pass away? And I hope not survives, but thrives. Why? Because I started losing some friends, heart attacks, cancers. And I'm 57. I mean, that's supposedly young. I started thinking of that. And of course, there was no more inventory of any MBNF at any of our retailers. And they all had massive waiting lists. And they all came back to us going, how can I get more? And I said, no, you're not. No. How can I get more? We're not making more. And then one of them came back and said, if I open a boutique for you on Rodeo Drive and I pay for everything, can I get more watches? And then you're like, oh, maybe that's one of the keys of making that this brand can survive me. That it's not only a persona to persona brand, where we had a few multi-brands retailers who had one showcase, which was empty. We need to have maybe a bigger presence. And in a way, even though we don't grow our business, it becomes a brand. And then Michael Tay did the same in Singapore, Laurent Picciotto in Paris, etc. And we had to up our production. So over 2020 to 2024, we more or less increased our production about 30 to 40 watches more every year, which was incredibly difficult. And until 23, sorry. And in 23, we did 419 watches. And already in Jan 23, we said, okay, for the next 4 years, we're not growing anymore. That's it. That was difficult enough. And we need now the dust to settle and for us to be able to manage this with the quality we need to give our clients. So now the plan is for the next 4 or 5 years, whatever the demand is no growth.
What's the hardest part of being an independent Swiss brand today?
For the first two decades, from the 2000s to 2020, was clearly to be heard. And to have a voice which would be heard and people would resonate on say, well, like, and it was horribly tough for all of us. And since 2020, clearly the demand is there. Our issue now is, and it's always been, but it's become much more critical, is on the manufacturing, on the artisanship, on the subcontractors. We were one of a handful of watch brands which still hand finished every movement and still do. And actually, most people don't know that. So now it's become more complicated because it's become more fashionable to hand finish. And it's a good thing. I'm very happy, by the way. But the amount of artisans capable of doing it are the same, but the amount of smaller brands or even sometimes larger brands who want to do some special pieces hand finished have increased. And that's one of our many, many bottlenecks. The other one is R&D engineers. We're still desperately looking for R&D engineers. We've got so many ideas and just not enough. We don't have enough people to engineer what we have in mind. And that's not easy because we're in an industry which a lot of brands have been very evolutive. And so we take that good old 11 and a half line movement and we make it evolve. And we're not into that world. We're into completely creating from scratch and pretty wild mechanical movements. So it's not that easy to find the people who can do that also. So I think that's our biggest issue today.
Earlier, you alluded to the idea of succession, and this kind of brings me to some of the most recent reasons that MB&F was in the news over the summer, that Chanel had taken a minority investment stake in your company. So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about why now and then why Chanel?
So exactly what I was telling you, turn of the 2020s, starting to understand, and it was really a project that we discussed with the whole team. How does this brand survive me? So we started changing a lot of things internally. And there was one issue which I couldn't wrap my head around, is succession itself. Now, I'm 57. My two daughters are 7 and 11. I have no idea if they'll want to work in the company, and I have no idea if they'll have any talent, which sort of statistically is a pretty daunting perspective. And it's a 20-year gamble, because you don't put a 20-year-old at the head of a company. Already, if you put a 30-year-old, it's pretty rough. So I will know in about 20 years if they want to join the company and if they're good enough. And I will be close to 80. Do I want to gamble the future of MB&F on that? That would be completely irresponsible. So we started with Serge, who's our technical director, who joined me 16 years ago, and he had 20% and I have had 80%, thinking we need a partner. And it had to be a privately owned company. which has a very long-term thinking, which overinvests, which doesn't care about growth or profits. And of course, Chanel had showed what they'd done. They'd helped Romain Gauthier. They'd helped F. Pigeon. And we know from both of our friends that they're always there just to help. And it was interesting because 2.5 years ago, they had invited us at Watches and Wonders because our folding buckles at MBNF for the last 20 years have been made by Chanel. And our HM1, 2, 3, 4, 5, LM1, LM2 cases were made by Chanel. Not by Chanel per se, but by the company called GF Châtelain, which is owned by Chanel, and which makes all the J12s, etc. So we've known them for over 20 years, and Serge used to work for them. So we've had a long relationship with them. They invited Serge and I to Watches and Wonders, as they do every year, to have a coffee. And during the discussion, they said, so how can we help you? I said, oh, it's interesting that you're asking that question. Maybe you can help us. And so basically for 2 years, we had breakfasts and lunches and dinners, and we got to learn who we were and discover what makes us tick. And beginning of this year, they said, look, if you guys want to go ahead, we're ready to go ahead. And we said, okay. So it makes sure that if I pass away, my family inherits the company. So now I've got 60%, so my family inherits 60%. They will not sell to the wrong company. They have a family-owned business, which is very long-term thinking, which is there to help in case something happens to me. And that's taken an enormous weight off my shoulder. So I really sleep much better at night thanks to that. What's it going to change to the company? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. They're a minority shareholder. And as I told you, I sold them a business plan with zero growth and actually less profit every year. And they may be able to help us in the whole ecosystem of manufacturing. I'm sure they can help us there. But for the rest, it's not going to change anything to the company.
Well, this is what I was going to ask. Maybe we can double click on it just for a moment. From the collector and enthusiast perspective, for those that love the brand MBNF, anything in particular they can expect over the short or long term from the brand that might change or not really?
Are we talking again of the Chanel investment? Nothing. That's not going to change anything in the company or in the products. So no, I don't think it's going to be a J12 with BNF movement, as there has not been a J12 with a F. Pigeon movement, guys. And I've heard that. I've heard a lot of things in the last couple of weeks. Product-wise, the whole... And they didn't even ask us what we're doing. And it was interesting because during the two years we got to know that, I was like, so what do you guys want? I know what I'm going to gain, the company is going to gain in this, but what do you want? And their answer was always the same. We want to help you. Like, really? Do you want us to create a movement for you guys? Oh, thank you very much. No, that's okay. We don't need that. Oh, okay. Do you want us to come up with ideas? Oh, that's very kind of you, but no, we don't need that. But if you want to, yeah, sure. Absolutely incredibly elegant they've been. And they've got a history of helping artisans and creators to basically, in some cases, survive. We were not at all in a survival mode, but in this case, for their succession.
Max, the last question, something we do with most of our guests, is something cool on your desk. And I would be remiss not to ask you if you could show us something cool on your desk, either a watch, piece of mechanical kinetic art, anything else you've got lying around that the listeners would like to hear about.
Gosh, I've got so many things on my desk. I've got three Jaeger LeCoultre 8-day clocks, which I absolutely love, all different colors, the green, the red, and the blue. I have a 1960s Pierre Cardin super cool watch with a Jaeger. Those were Jaeger LeCoultre movements in the 60s. What do I have here? Oh, I've got my, I love clocks. I've got tons of clocks. I've got an Hermès 8-day Westgate. The Canon clock and weather station, which I love. And behind me, as you can see, there's a ton of weird stuff. I've got my whole life of weird stuff around me.
Max, we could keep going, but we're going to have to let you go. Thank you so much for making for a wonderful episode of Hodinkee Radio. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Vic Ottomanelli for editing. And of course, thanks to Ben Clymer for joining as well. And we'll see you all again next week for another episode.